Dr. Oz Guinness was born in China, educated in the UK, England, University of London for his undergrad work, and Oxford University, from which he received the Doctor of Philosophy degree in the social sciences. He's been a reporter for the BBC, a guest scholar for several institutions, particularly dealing with public policy. Dr. Guinness has authored or edited more than 25 books, one of which you will receive tonight as you leave the room. His most recent book has an intriguing title, something that ought to be of interest to all of us who deal with where in the world does all the trouble in the world come from in the first place. And the title of his most recent book is called Unspeakable, Facing Up to the Challenge of Evil. Not going to be his topic tonight, however, but please welcome with me Dr. Oz Guinness.
Thank you, John. Thank you all. It's a tremendous honor for me to be here. I remember when I was a boy hearing Doug Hammarskjöld say that the purpose of the United Nations was not to save humanity for heaven, but to save it from hell. And saying elsewhere that he hoped, because of the United Nations, the second half of the 20th century and the subsequent centuries would be different from the horrors of the first half of the 20th century. So although there are parts of this country where the United Nations is much maligned, I think what you're doing is not only deeply necessary, but profoundly noble. And I'm truly honored to be asked to speak to you tonight. Thank you. I want to speak to you, not so much as a lecture, but just speak as one human being to other human beings, and you also are leaders. There's a story from Europe at the end of the 19th century when Bismarck was on his deathbed, the great German chancellor. And a friend asked him, what would be the decisive factor in the 20th century? And he remarked famously, it's the fact that Americans speak English. From my part of the world, we wouldn't agree with the fact that they all speak English, but that wasn't his point. In his day, the British Empire was the largest, strongest force on earth, but within 20 years had declined and faded. And the vacuum was filled not by the victor of a European conflict of powers, but by the United States. And the last century was the American century. But I'm moved by the fact that at the beginning of the 21st century, as we move around leadership circles and scholarly circles, there's a sense that no one factor will be decisive in our time, but that there are three of major significance. The first, will Islam modernize peacefully? Secondly, which faith will come to replace Marxism in China and lead China forward as she becomes a great world superpower? And thirdly, will the West, which has grown out of Greek and Roman and Jewish and Christian beliefs, will the West recover or sever its roots? Now, if you see the significance of those three questions, what links them all are the fact that each of them assumes a faith or an ideology. Now again, when I was a student, the dominant idea in much of the Western world, certainly in Europe, was what was called the secularization theory. Put simply, the more modern the world gets, the less religious it gets. And religion would be like the lingering grin of Lewis Carroll's cat, and the cat would disappear and the grin would remain. Religion would disappear as the sun of the Enlightenment and the modern world arose. In those days, they would say there was one exception, the United States. And America was both the most modern country in the world and bucked the trend and was also the most religious of modern countries in the world, as religious as India. That, of course, was 50 years ago, and everyone admits that that was terribly wrong. The idea of the secularization, of the modernization of the world, has been profoundly challenged by reality. As one scholar said last year, religion in the world is as furiously alive as ever. Today, America is not the exception. Europe is the exception. And even Europe is not as secular as it was once thought to be. But you can see a much greater understanding today that, for better or worse, the religious factor is absolutely key to understanding the world and the world of the future. Lord Acton, who's famous for the remark, "Absolute all power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely," was also the one who said that religion has to be understood as the key to history. And I'm sure all of you, coming from different civilizations and different cultures, know the extraordinary significance of faith as the key to your history. As you look at the West, for instance, my own civilization, you can see that faith underlies the rise of the universities, the rise of modern science, the rise of capitalism, the rise of democracy, the rise of the great reform movements, including the abolition of slavery through much of the world. All of these, directly or indirectly, either inspired by faith or led by people of faith. And nobody could understand the West without understanding the place of faith. But of course, as the world globalizes, that creates a simple but profound challenge. We are now aware of all the differences in our world. It's often said everyone is now everywhere, which is exaggerated, but you see the point. Through our media, through our travel, we are always aware of all the others at almost every moment today. And the question comes to us, how do we live with our deepest differences? Especially when we realize that our faiths are not little private worldviews that we leave at home, but they shape the very way we see ourselves and understand our worlds. And in many modern societies, no longer do you have homogeneous societies where one faith is dominant, but now scores of faiths, all living within the same society. And the question of how we live with our deepest differences grows sharper and sharper all the time, especially as we are seeing the emergence of what I would call a global public square. You know the idea of a public square. For those of us in the West, it goes back to the Greeks, who had this tremendous sense that there were three people in any society, tribes people who thought only as groups. What the Greeks called idiots, which didn't mean someone who was a little nutty, but rather someone who could only think of themselves and their individual interests. And then the third category, which is the one they valued, citizens. People who argued for their own interests, but also had a strong view of the common good of the whole of society. And that notion of the common vision for the common good lies behind the Western understanding of the rise of a public square. But you can see today, for example, the internet, the Pope's recent speech at Regensburg, or the Danish cartoons. We are in a world where you don't have to speak to the world to be heard by the world. And with the internet flowing everywhere now, you can see the creation of a global public square. And the question of how we live with our differences in such a global public square is more urgent than ever. As the discussion goes on in places like Davos and other places, you can see that there are three options put out, and I would argue that two of them are extremes. On the one hand, there are many who would be described as progressive universalists. They believe that their one way is the way for everybody, even if you have to force them to believe that way. And that doesn't just include people in the past like communists or certain religions who would do that today. There are certain Democrats and certain feminists who would force their views on the world. And obviously, in a world of diversity like ours, that will lead to one word, conflict. The other extreme is what is called multicultural relativists. Those who believe there are many different cultures, many different faiths, many different values, so nobody has the right to judge anyone else at all, and we all just shrug our shoulders as the French do, or as the teenagers say, whatever. That's their way, let them do their thing, and so on. Which on the surface sounds much more tolerant. But in fact, that means we would turn a blind eye to things that are evil and dehumanizing. Some parts of the world practicing things in relation to women, or still the survival of slavery, or the abuse of human rights. But the multicultural relativists would say there's no such thing as anyone having universal human rights. The better position, I think, is what's called covenantal pluralism. The recognition that there are many different faiths and many different values, but we need to have a covenant of how we respect each other's rights so that when we differ, we know how to differ with respect to the rights of other people and be very clear of the few and rare times at which there will have to be in international relations interventions in the name of human rights and justice and freedom. And you can see that this discussion is going around the world today because people realize that faith is absolutely inescapable and absolutely central. But that, in a way, is the public question. How do we live with our deepest differences? But of course, the deeper question is the personal question. How do we make choices in a world in which we're aware of all the other different choices we make? So the old way of just believing what our parents, grandparents, and our culture believed because it came down in the rain with our culture has gone. At the heart of the modern world is choice and change. And the challenge is each of us as human beings who want to make sense of our lives, to find meaning and belonging in this world, to really choose in a deeply thoughtful and responsible way. Probably the most famous Western quotation from the classical times is the saying of Socrates, the great Greek philosopher, "The unexamined life is not worth living." The unexamined life is not worth living. If he's right, sadly, there are many people in the West who are living lives that are not worth living because they've not examined their lives at all. They hardly think about the meaning of life or how they make sense of this world in which we live. But if you look at those who have lived an examined life, you can see that they move through certain stages in their thinking, which any thoughtful person does, to get to a place where they can say, "This is my faith, and I've thought it through in a deep way in relation to all the other choices." Usually for such people, step one is always this: a time for questions. People who have no questions at all, no curiosity, are not in any way really serious seekers. But what defines a seeker is someone for whom life has become a question, and they want to find the answer that provides the meaning. The great Jewish scholar George Steiner remarked, "We human beings are not so much Homo sapiens as Homo quirens, the animal that asks and asks and asks." Life doesn't come to us ready explained when we're born. We want to make sense of it. We ask questions of it to find the answers that throw light on all the other answers. And always, it's when we start asking questions about the deepest things of life, from the beginning of the human race right down to the prospects for the human race in this world and the very nature of life and the cosmos itself. Is it an accident? Or is there design and a plan behind it? Do we have meaning? Or are we human beings merely accidents too? A time for questions. I must say, living in Washington rather than New York, Many people there are so pressured and so pragmatic that they really have not thought through the deepest meaning of life. And I would just challenge you to be people who are serious about the examined life and begin a time for questions. The second great phase in a serious life is a time for answers. That follows logically. We've got questions, we want answers. But you can see our world has thousands of answers. And yet, as I look at it, and I've lived on three continents and studied under a guru and lived 10 years in a Buddhist culture, as well as my own European background and 20 years here, there are actually only so many broad families of answers. Families in the philosopher's sense, that they have a family resemblance because they all come from the same understanding of what's ultimate reality. And seen that way, you have a broad Eastern family of faiths, Hinduism, Buddhism, the New Age, a broad secularist family of faiths, the atheists, the agnostics, materialists, naturalists, and the broad biblical family of faiths, supremely in the West, the Jews and the Christians. And unlike those who say, well, they're all roughly the same. If we're nice enough to each other and talk long enough, we'll get down to the common core. Nobody has actually found the common core. And the fact is, as you can see by looking at our civilizations, the differences are not just theoretical. The differences make an extraordinary difference in practice. For example, take the notion of human rights, much discussed in the world today. Many of our secularist friends have no basis for human rights. If humans are just an accident thrown in the universe, why should any of us have a dignity that's different from the animals? And you can see that many humanists now talk of human rights as a species chauvinism, human arrogance, thinking we're any different from any of the animals. And the fact is, their faith, their philosophy, their worldview has profound practical consequences in an area like human rights. The differences make a huge difference. But Christmas is a wonderful time to think these things through. Because you can see much of the purity and the simplicity of the Christian faith at Christmas. Some of you may have thought when I talked about the progressive universalists, those who believe that their one way is the way for everybody, that would include Christians. No. Sadly, that did in the past, say the Emperor Constantine in the 3rd century or some of the people in the Middle Ages, that did include some Christians who coerced people at the point of a sword. But Christmas is a very clear reminder that's not Jesus. Sometime you should read the wonderful Gospel of Luke. And the 2nd chapter tells you the birth of Jesus. I love history. I love reading the lives of the great captains of history, the great conquerors in history, the great civilization builders in history. Nothing could be further from Jesus. An unwed mother giving birth to her baby in a stable because the inns were full and they had no room. The first people to come were the poorest in the area, the shepherds who had to live out in the fields. And so it goes on, not a great captain of history, but someone who came to be a servant to humanity, to live, yes, as a great teacher, but to give his life to establish good news and to give his life to establish justice. There's a wonderful simplicity and a purity about the Christmas story that with all the consumerism you'll see around you in New York and all the sentiment that will gush from the radio here and there over the next months, if you go back to the actual story itself, you'll see something that is quite different and a remarkable pointer for our world. The great atheist woman philosopher Simone de Beauvoir, who was the mistress of Jean-Paul Sartre, she was famous for her atheism and attacking religions of all sorts. And once at the end of her life, a journalist came to her and said, "Madame de Beauvoir, what does it feel like to have repudiated belief in God totally?" And she looked at the journalist and she said, "It's one thing to banish water, but I'm afraid I've never been able to banish thirst." You can see in our world that much of the West thought we'd got beyond religion. But we're actually in a world where, as one great thinker put it, either the future will be religious or it will not be. But the question comes, how do we live with our differences? And above all, which of the deep and many faiths is the one which supplies the deepest answer to the human longings? And as we look at it in depth, can be seen to be true. What a wonderful time Christmas is to think of some of these deep things, and I'd recommend that you do. Thank you.